This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Welcome to the Book Riot Podcast. It's a weekly news and talk show about what's new, cool, and worth talking about in the world of books and reading. It is Friday, March 5th, and I definitely know that it's 2021.
I was wondering if we were going to time travel this week.
I have to say, I enjoyed how much other people enjoyed the flub and your subsequent needling me of it. Our staff enjoyed it. People on Twitter enjoyed me talking about the olden times of being human Google. Got some nice emails about last week's show as a favorite. Remember we had someone ask which episodes to
Yeah.
I guess that one, in terms of pleasure, was probably a top 10. Is it representative? I don't know. I didn't love that my flub was the funniest thing I've ever done. That's not what I'm trying to do here.
I don't know that it's the funniest thing you've ever done.
Thank you very much. I'm not fishing for compliments, but I'm glad to reel one in.
Yeah, you know, it was funny, and it was very unexpected. Mm. And maybe that's what it is. Like, usually the Jeff humor, I can kind of guess, like, we're going to have a pun. There's going to be some puns here. Yeah. But just time traveling us back. And then you committed to the bit, and we stayed in 2018 for a while. And I think that's really what made it magical.
I do commit to bits. That's true of me. I'm very loyal to the bit show title. Also, I realized, too, that I don't usually mess up the date after doing 400 and some odd. It's some odd of these. I think that might be the first time I flubbed the actual year. Before. Yeah. I don't remember it happening before, which is weird because I mess stuff up all the time. Anyway, there's that. I have some more listener feedback, but let's take our first sponsor break before we get there.
Today's episode is brought to you by The Dial Press, publishers of The Prospects by KT Hoffman. The pressure cooker of minor league baseball leads to major chemistry in this exhilarating, sexy, and triumphant Rivals to Lovers debut romance. Gene Ionescu is the first openly trans player in professional baseball. He has nearly everything he's ever let himself dream of. That is, until Luis Estrada, Gene's former teammate and current rival, gets traded to the Beavers. Now, Gene and Luis can't manage a civil conversation off the field or a competent play on it, but in the close confines of dugout benches and roadie buses, they begrudgingly rediscover a comfortable rhythm. As the two grow closer, the tension between them turns electric and their chemistry spills past the confines of the stadium. So this is one of the first adult rom-coms published by a major publishing house centering a gay trans man by a gay trans man. It also has ADHD and anxiety representation and some joyful, heartfelt moments. Make sure to check it out. And thanks again to The Dial Press, publishers of The Prospects by KT Hoffman, for sponsoring this episode. Today's episode is brought to you by WW Norton & Company Incorporated. So, Negative Space by Jillian Linden follows a week in the life of an English teacher at a New York private school. At home, her children ask constant questions about mortality, and her husband offers occasional counsel between Zoom calls. At school, something happens. She accidentally witnesses an ambiguous, possibly inappropriate interaction between a teacher and a student, but how can she be sure of what she saw? Negative Space is a portrait of a woman caught between the pressures of what's normal and what isn't, and examines what we owe the people who depend on us in a fractured and indifferent world. It's a debut novel and a short novel. It's perfect if you want something quick and easy to carry around, but it's also thought-provoking. It takes place during the pandemic, but it's not pandemic-focused, and it really just looks at everyday anxieties in low-threat situations that have high consequences. So make sure to check out Negative Space by Jillian Linden. And thanks again to WW Norton & Company Incorporated for sponsoring this episode.
As I said, a lot of people wrote in saying they enjoyed the episode and laughing at, with, around, in my general area. Again, this is one of those situations where I'm not even sure what it's called, where the people who like the thing are going to say they're going to like it, but the people who don't maybe won't, about the would I like this segment or would I like this mini podcast? A lot, everyone who mentioned it said they would love it. I'm assuming the people who are like, meh, don't write in. So I don't know what to do with that data. I'm still not too sure what to do with it myself. We had some other, you know, staff people and contributors say that'd be interesting. I'd like that. I don't really know what to do with it. I'm kind of interested in it. Did you think about this at all? We haven't talked about it.
I did. And I did think about it. And I actually kind of had a specific use case for it because I read the new Patricia Lockwood novel over the weekend.
Right.
And I feel like that is one that would be ripe for a should you read this kind of moment.
Should the show be called Content Warning? Trigger Warning?
Probably.
Because, I mean, not to, I don't know how you do this. I guess content warnings are inherently minor spoilers of some, or like that something's going to happen. That one has a thing you said is a thing in it, right?
It is a thing.
I'm communicating in code during World War II, trying not to get my thing blacked out.
This piece of content contains a piece of content.
The Crow Flies at Midnight about Patricia
Lockwood's
new book.
Well, synopsis for it that the publisher provides says, you know, this is a story of a woman who has like a super plugged in online life and gets famous on the internet until she gets a text from her mother that says something like, something is wrong, how soon can you get here? And then after that, everything changes in her life and what's going to happen. And I mean, the Patricia Lockwood writing about the internet is wonderful and so sardonic, and I really appreciated it. The thing that happens,
spoiler warning, fast forward 2 minutes if you don't want to hear,
involves a very sick baby that is very sick for lots of pages of the book. And that is difficult and painful to read about in all the ways that you would imagine that's difficult and painful to read about. And I'm just a normal person who doesn't want to read about very sick babies. I haven't had personal experiences that make that extra difficult for me. And I was like, man, this is a real one to get walloped with if you don't see it coming.
And that's like my number one draft pick on stuff I don't want to read. You know this about me.
Yeah.
Like that's like, that's it. The dog can die. I'm sorry. Dogs are fine. But like,
bad
I'm
things
cannot
happen
this.
To kids. Yeah.
Yeah. Can't do it. Can't do it. Can't do it. Yeah. Huh. So in that situation now, how would that affect? Because you would like to talk about that, or like, and someone wants to know, or like, how does that fit into our shtick that we're talking about here?
In the should I read it, I think in this book, for this book, if you can tolerate that content,
gotcha.
The choice that she made there is like rich fodder for conversation. I have a lot of questions about it. I'm not sure that I loved that as a narrative device, but it certainly does interesting things to the character. And the ways that she captures the online life of this woman are really powerful. So you should definitely read the first half of the new Patricia Lockwood book. If you can tolerate the content of the second half, I think there's a lot to talk about. I was complaining before I read it that some of the reviews of it are just as like obtuse and hard to pin down as Lockwood's writing is itself. And I think it's because
I noticed the same thing.
Yeah, that the novel is like, it's not one you're going to say was a fun read. And it's hard to say, was that good? I'm not sure. But
that's interesting.
A lot of things.
Yeah, I think that speaks to the heart of kind of the framing of this thing that we may or may not ever actually do that we're interested in talking about. Like, should I read it is different than is it good, right? Because should I read it is different people might have different shoulds, and you can approach books in, as we know, many different kinds of ways, and it's not a binary. Some books are good for some people and bad for, but one way of framing it might be if you're going to get something out of this book if, or avoid this book if. Sort of that could be like kind of a pro-con way of thinking about and framing the recommendation is not quite right. Because recommendation indicates a sort of thumbs up or thumbs down.
Yeah.
That's not my style, as you know.
Right.
Equivocation is my jam, for sure.
the Jeff O'Neill story.
The Jeff O'Neill story. Or is it?
We'll be here for another 17 hours today.
It's funny stuff. Let's see. Any other listener feedback to pass along? I think that's it for right now. There's some stuff I might group together for a future episode as people have given us some feedback about other stuff. Well, we had a story in Books and Reading this week that broke out beyond the world of Books and Reading. Dr. Seuss's, six of Dr. Seuss's books, the Seuss Enterprise, which is the, it's weird when you think about it in these terms, it is the enduring IP holder of the deceased Theodore Geisel's collected works, right? Yeah. And they get to decide what to do with the books. They profit from it. And they decided that six of the books in the Seuss catalog that they've been publishing and profiting from, they no longer were comfortable or wanted to, or whatever reason they decided to pull, because of harmful stereotypes and representations. I have to admit, I didn't look at the specific things. Did you? Do you see any?
No.
Did you look at any specific representations? I didn't either. And I did that on purpose. One, I don't like to look at racist stuff on the whole. And B, I didn't want to get into the game of parsing exactly, like, which part is it? And is it racist? Like, I'm totally not interested in that right now. I assume you're the same way.
Yeah, I am. And I also was thinking about, like, the, you know, the entity that owns the IP, and they did, they made this decision in conjunction with the publisher, has the least incentive to make a decision like this, because it will cost, it will cost them money, or very potentially will cost them money, because they have fewer books to sell now. And so if they're at the place of concluding this stuff is racist and bad and we don't want to be responsible for putting it in the world, like, I trust that. I don't want to relitigate it. And even if they were somehow, like, wrong about it, I'd rather, like, in the, and I can't imagine that they were, I would rather catch some, you know, false positives and err on the side of, you know, protecting readers from encountering harmful content. So yeah, I didn't feel the need to investigate the specifics here.
So the actual specifics of the case, if it hadn't become, like, a big thing that, like, in my Facebook feed that I was looking, doing my, like, once or twice weekly, like, Facebook world, I was getting recommendations for, like, local coverage of this, with, and the, and the stories had, like, thousands of likes on it. So the actual story itself, I guess you wouldn't, people listening to the show wouldn't be surprised that we're like, yeah, it's your private IP, it's racist, pull this stuff. No one has a right to be in print. Things go out of print all the time. Like, Disney pulls, you can't watch Song of the South on Disney Plus for very good and understandable reasons. And so this became a thing that people got really upset about. And I think that is the more important, that's the more interesting conversation than the thing that actually happened to me.
Yeah. And I think it's that it was misrepresented intentionally to make people very upset.
Oh,
about
you think
it.
So?
That, well, yeah, who did I think it? That if who, I think if who, the headlines had been, you know, Dr. Seuss decides to unpublish six of Dr. Seuss's own books. Dr. Seuss holds self accountable. Details at 10.
Like, Seuss cancels self.
Exactly. Yeah. There's no story there. Like, this wasn't imposed by some outside entity. Right. The people who own the material decided not to continue publishing it. But it's been co-opted into this story about cancel culture, and we're ruining children's childhoods by taking Dr. Seuss books off the shelves. And then I didn't look at Amazon today, but yesterday, like,
most
of the top 10 books on Amazon were Dr. Seuss titles. They weren't these Dr. Seuss titles, which, of course, some of these are still in print and are available to buy, like, if you're in the market for some racist children's books. But there were people flooding to buy Dr. Seuss books, I guess, in support of Dr. Seuss, like, not wanting Dr. Seuss to get canceled. But, like, joke's on you, because Dr. Seuss canceled himself.
I was going to say, if this is a guerrilla marketing ploy by the Seusses, you know, I don't, what... I don't understand what,
like,
people
Fox
think
News
is happening.
Fox News is just all over it, and I think conservative pundits have run with this and twisted it into, like, the big bad, like, woke media, woke culture, cancel culture is taking your Dr. Seuss from you. Aren't you mad? What about the children?
Yeah,
and the it's just such a blatant misreading of the very simple facts of the case. Like, Dr. Seuss cancels self.
The freedom of speech case being made is you have to keep saying racist stuff, even if you don't want to. That's a weird look. How is that a freedom of speech question? It's weird. So weird.
And I think, I'd love to see more of this. Like, I was thinking about the Streisand effect with this. And if you took, say, some popular classics that have racist representations in them, maybe the publishers of those books or the folks who hold those trusts should decide to stop publishing them and then people will rush to buy those to rush look, to buy listen, their books
the
anyway.
The third book in the Smiley trilogy by John Le Carré, which is set in Asia. Let's just say we'd like to walk that one back if we could. Mm-hmm. Some representation stuff there. If they pulled that, the sales of Tinker Tailor and Smiley's people would go through the roof. It would. It's kind of a similar situation.
I don't think this was cancel yourself as a PR move or as a sales move, but it worked that way. And
it worked.
It's just one more thing on the pile of most of the stories around like your limiting speech or think about the children because they need access to racist books or whatever are grounded in either fundamental misunderstandings or fundamental misrepresentations of the facts. Like folks who are thinking critically are not engaged in this discourse.
No. And listen, I know a little bit about Dr. Seuss as a writer. Like he was hugely influential in making sort of pop children's primer books a thing, right? I think I've told this story before. It's an annotated what I consider doing about how Dr. Seuss became the de facto children's series around, you know, I think it was an article in Time or Life about the benefits of kids reading and getting kids to read early. And the thing that was out there was these Seuss books that had basically no uptake that was available and became a phenomenon. And we've talked about this before. We've done whole podcast segments previously about how Oh, the Places You Go is like basic person graduation gifting stuff. And the phenomenon where it is the best-selling book in America every year through like May 29th or something as it's given. Mm-hmm. And it has been that way for 60 years. We really should rename like the milk cow metaphor the Dr. Seuss of something because it has provided more ongoing IP revenue than probably pick your world building. Maybe Harry Potter. I know. Welcome to opening another can of worms, but maybe that. But that's only been around 20 years. Like we're talking 60 years of Seussian royalties being generated. So I guess I shouldn't be surprised that the misrepresentations and the simplifications of what was happening touched a nerve. Because that is the nerve, maybe. It might be the nerve in contemporary, like, adults' nostalgia for children's books. It is Dr. Seuss. And I don't think there's anyone that's even close. Is there? Can you think of one?
No. I don't think there's anybody even close. And we see it in adults' nostalgia for things they read as younger people in maybe it's shifted in recent years, but in the like deep adherence to declaring To Kill a Mockingbird to be the best, most important work of American fiction. You know, like for the first 5 years of Book Riot's life, at least, we could not conduct a reader survey about your favorite book without the answer.
We stopped doing it. Wasn't interesting.
Being To Kill a Mockingbird. It was just so boringly predictable. And like, okay, you had an experience. Also, you had that experience in a particular historical context. And aren't we all trying, hopefully we're not, but I wish we were, to grow and evolve. Like I say this all the time on this podcast, but I want the things that I loved 30 years ago to be outdated now.
Yeah,
I want to live in a culture that has evolved. And I think this is a great sign. I would love to see publishers do more of this because also more taking old, especially old beloved things where like we've turned off our critical thinking about the thing. It's just so beloved that we keep loving it. Take the ones that aren't relevant off the shelves and open up space and marketing dollars and attention. Like, the attention economy is a limited thing. Open up space there for new works that are doing the kind of work that we want books to do today.
And Geisel himself, again, another thing where I know less of the specifics, or I once did, and I've forgotten the specifics, had some real anti-Semitic stuff going on. Mm-hmm. Like there's real issues about him himself. And I haven't seen, and maybe it's out there, a wider sort of call to get rid of Cat in the Hat. I mean, you know, one heuristic we've thought about before on the show and a very complicated and evolving understanding of our own relationship to IP and authors who have said or represent or publicly declared stuff that we've believed to be harmful. being dead is a bright line we've drawn, right? Is that there's a person themselves benefiting from it literally, and is the consumption or buying of a particular work trumpeting a particular position? Yeah. Now, maybe there is a close anti-Semitic reading of Cat in the Hat out there. I don't know. Maybe there is. Podcast at bookriot.com. But with Dr. Seuss, I think at this point if you want to read Cat in the Hat, I guess that's okay. I think Dr. Seuss is overrated. Let me just say it. Not my thing. I've never liked it. Too simple. I don't like the art, these weird, like, Giacometti puppet sock people things. I don't get the whole aesthetic. I've never liked it. So whatever. Go forth and read Green Eggs and Ham. But I think it is interesting to see even a self-reckoning among some circles is beyond the pale. Is beyond the pale of what can be broached in thinking about revisiting, amending what gets put out into the world. I guess I shouldn't be surprised by this stuff, but I'm still surprised it got this kind of like thing that the Seuss Enterprise is like, you know what? There's some stuff in the catalog. Also, none of these people liking these posts on Facebook could name any of these six books. Mm-hmm. That got pulled. There's maybe one that I'd heard of, but if you asked me to organically generate it, it'd be like number 15 on the Dr. Seuss books.
Yeah, these are not the popular titles that we think of when someone's right. like, hey, name a Dr. Seuss children's book. Yeah. And yeah, I just think it's so telling that the facts of this are being presented or misrepresented really in the way that they are, where all that's happened here is that an entity that makes a thing has decided that that thing is harmful.
Right.
So they're not going to make it anymore. This is like, you know, your car gets recalled because a piece of it is damaging or, you know, could explode. You want to replace the thing, like recall the part. Self-editing should be part of this. And corners of our culture are so resistant to the notion that evolution of thought, I guess, is a good thing, that even an entity editing its own content is a problem. And I would bet, though, that if you went back to most of those people and said, like, were you aware that this was just Dr. Seuss, like the Dr. Seuss entity deciding to unpublish itself, they would not have been aware. And that's really too bad, because once we get stuck on what we think is the version of a story, even hearing new information that disconfirms, that doesn't alter the belief. So I'm sad that this is probably a...
I'm sad, yeah. I'm sad uphill, that it's getting calcified battle. Into AOC canceled Dr. Seuss or whatever people think is going on Instagram. Or TikTok, even worse. Even more inscrutable to it.
Oh my God, TikTok cancels Dr. Seuss. It's like a very 2021 fake headline.
I'm not even sure what I'm saying at this point. So the frustration with it, I think, is about the story rather than the thing that actually happened. I guess I find my attention even more drawn to the more nebular questions. I've got an email from a librarian saying people have now checked out all of the books that have been pulled, and they assume they're never going to get them back because you can now get hundreds and thousands of dollars on them on eBay. At least you could. Until eBay said they're not going to host listings for these six books now. You can't resell them on eBay. How do you like them apples?
Well, I like the tax on people who are willing to pay thousands of dollars to buy a racist book no one wants.
I think they're going to think it's going to be a collector's item, I guess.
I mean, may your efforts succeed.
You can't. Why didn't you go buy Bitcoin like all the other dummies? Don't do this. Go buy Bitcoin like a regular dummy. Don't buy racist Dr. Seuss books speculatively. Too much? Too much. Librarians are also wondering about school librarians to keep them on the shelves now. Pull them. Just pull them. But you got to fight the people who've now seen the thing on Facebook. Not easy.
I mean,
I get
that
it's
sucks.
Not easy.
That does suck. Like,
that does suck.
The information that, like, the people who control Dr. Seuss's work made this decision themselves should be compelling, but that's not to say that people are acting logically and that it will be. But
is it censorship segment, like Letterman's Is It Something or Nothing?
Oh my God, it's almost always
it's
no.
When is it? Have we ever had a real,
no.
I mean...
Oh no, we had. There was early in the Trump administration, there were stories about them, like about the administration trying to like cease publication.
Of Bolton's book, right?
Yeah. And that was the only, in our time doing this show, that was the only actual example, like government intervention or threat of punishment for speech.
Yeah. And the edge cases are a library system pulling a book, I guess, right? Because as a government, you're not being punished for it, but it's saying that we're not going to buy copies and keep it in our publicly funded library system. eBay, I saw one, I'm not going to mention the name because it doesn't matter, but a blogger that I've been following for a long time who doesn't link to book-related stuff, linked to the story about eBay pulling the Dr. Seuss stuff and says, you know, book censorship of any kind is a bad sign. I was like, yeah, it would be. If this were book censorship.
If this were censorship, plug your brain in.
You know, what do you want to do with it? But I do sympathize with the librarians who, like the booksellers we talked about in relation to Andy Ngo's book, I don't know how to say the last time. I'm so sorry. Podcast at bookriot.com. I sympathize where the practical ramifications of making a moral choice might be out of scale with the moral benefit you're getting from it.
It's interesting to think about what this would be, how this would be going down if Dr. Seuss were still alive. Like if Dr. Seuss were making the morning show rounds, if he was on the Today Show this morning going, you know what, stuff in six of my books is racist and I've evolved since then and take them off your shelves. Would people be wringing their hands about it? Like you're looking at the author's face and he is saying, I don't want this work to be available. And that should carry weight. And in the absence of that author, since he's dead, the wishes of his estate or the folks who manage the IP should carry the weight there. I think that's, I mean, all of this is so justifiable, but in the like, literally the people who produce this thing no longer want to be responsible for putting it out in the world. Can't we just respect that?
Yeah. I mean, and I don't know you have any leg to stand on. Like, I'm trying to think of like not a counter example, but a different example where something I love got pulled because the author said, you know, I don't want that in the world. Like, you know, if Marilynne Robinson said, I don't want Gilead out in the world because of there's this passage that I can't abide, I would be sad, but I'd be like, Marilynne Robinson, what are you doing? Because that's your work. I mean, eventually it'll come in the public domain. I've got my copy. I don't know.
And the reality of publishing, and which you kind of got at earlier, is that most books cease being published at some point. Right. And for most books, that's sooner rather than later. Most books don't stay in print for 50 years. And if you go look at lists of even like bestsellers of 50 years ago, we haven't heard most of those titles. Very few of them are still available. So like either you're going to cancel yourself or publishing is going to cancel you by default at some point.
Yeah, either... you know, you die the hero, you live long enough to become out of print. It's kind of how
like,
it goes.
Right. It's just...
If you ever do want to see the trippiness of the ephemerality of even things that we think of being more corporeal than other parts of cultures in terms of books, go look at a bestseller list from like 1946. Mm-hmm. Have fun. I mean, you know me. I like this stuff.
It is. Those
and I'm still like, what is all this stuff?
Mm-hmm.
Edna Ferber.
And how many of them are racist? Probably a lot.
A lot. A super big a lot. And you know what? They're out of print and no one's mad. Let's do a sponsor.
Today's episode is brought to you by Harper Horizon, publisher of Walk Ride Paddle. Walk Ride Paddle is a captivating memoir of Senator Tim Kaine's physical journey through the Virginia wilderness, but it is also a unique and ultimately optimistic perspective on these pivotal moments in history, offering inspiration, wisdom, and hope. With immediacy and honesty, Kaine pulls back the curtain to reveal his inner thoughts during such monumental times. And Kaine's storytelling gift and wise observations offer a fascinating glimpse into the mind of a seasoned politician and outdoor enthusiast. Walk Ride Paddle is available everywhere audiobooks are sold on April 9th. It is narrated and written by Tim Kaine, Virginia Senator and former Democratic vice presidential candidate. It's a compelling account of one man's journey across hundreds of miles of Virginia wilderness and a moving testament to the optimistic spirit of America. So make sure to check out Walk Ride Paddle by Tim Kaine. And thanks again to Harper Horizon, publisher of Walk Ride Paddle, for sponsoring this episode. Today's episode is brought to you by Amazon Publishing. So I got a story with a little Old West debauchery, if you want to get a little messy. So there is a city steeped in the Old West mess. And in the city, a reporter is following every lead to a dangerous place, one that could bring him glory and fame or end his life. New York Times bestselling author Robert Dugoni is back with a gripping new thriller of corruption, vice, and murder set in Depression-era Seattle. It's about a reporter covering a hot murder trial who soon learns nothing is what it seems. The story can make his career if he lives to write about it. You can learn more at amazon.com/A Killing on the Hill. So yes, A Killing on the Hill by Robert Dugoni is what you need to pick up if you are into some Depression era danger in Seattle. It's a city of big dreams and dark ambitions, and this reporter gets caught up in the muck. So make sure to check it out. And thanks again to Amazon Publishing for sponsoring this episode.
Okay, I guess that was it. If you've got on the ground, sort of ethical weirdness around your job in Seuss, you know, librarian, bookseller, children's book person of some kind, I'm sure there's a lot of other ancillary cases, you know, edge cases, use cases, problems, and questions that are going to be asked over time. Also, if you've got a Seussian replacement for people that may be coming to the anti-Semitism of Theodore Geisel for the first time and looking like, geez, I'd like to get these off my shelves. I do not currently have Dr. Seuss on my shelf, I will tell you, for what that's worth. I'd like to hear them. But children's books, there's talk about a rich, target-rich environment for replacement. Yeah. Good Lord. Go into a book, well, when you can go into a bookstore. You're not going to be like, if it weren't for Dr. Seuss, whatever would we buy the children?
I mean, your kids are out there literally winning readathons without Dr. Seuss on
the readathon right now.
The kids are okay.
It's hard to get 45 minutes of reading out of Dr. Seuss. I'll tell you that too. If you're looking to put in units of reading, it's like, I just read Cat in the Hat 60 times and it's been 8 minutes. Do we talk about the Murakami? I love this story. You just put it in here. Is this something or nothing? I guess if it's an homage to Letterman Day, is this something or nothing, Rebecca?
I think it has riffing potential, but it's probably nothing in the big picture. Right. But yeah. We like riffing potential. So acclaimed Japanese novelist Haruki Murakami, who's known to be relatively reclusive or has the reputation of being pretty reclusive, is doing a t-shirt line with Uniqlo. And it's today in Unexpected Headlines. Murakami's doing a t-shirt line. It's going on sale in mid-March. They feature all of his favorite things, many of which are prevalent in his novels. Cats, birds, records, men sitting in bars. And he says he tries to keep it simple. He wears, jeans and a t-shirt with a sweatshirt or a sweater. And then there's this great quote, "But I always wind up wearing the same thing. I'm not sure I can say why that is," he reveals somewhat unrevealingly.
Hey, he reveals somewhat unrevealingly. Remember me talking about what we talk about when we talk about running or whatever that was? Yeah. I can't remember the name of the book, Murakami. Yeah. This is Murakami's like koan of himself. Like, I don't know what is going on with him.
I too am a human who wears clothing.
Fellow humans, clothing is indeed something I wear. Check out my line of t-shirts featuring a cat.
Right. So Allison Flood wrote this piece for The Guardian about this. And, it's an interview with Murakami as well, just trying to get him to talk about himself, because this is the thing about being reclusive, is it makes you even more appealing as an interview target. Because when is the person going to reveal some of their details? And I just saw this story 10 minutes before we came on to record, but it got me thinking about what are other novelist or writer fashion mashups that would be interesting, or just writer product lines that would be interesting.
Colson Whitehead's egg sandwich cart is one I would very much like. He's a big egg sandwich fan, a New Yorker through and through. I love an egg sandwich. I would trust him to curate my egg sandwich experience. That was a little ready for that one.
You were super ready. I love that that Colson Whitehead loves egg sandwiches. Yes. Yeah. I watched the 60 Minutes segment with him.
Oh, you did? I heard it was pretty great.
It is pretty great. I mean, he's wonderful. Yeah. And It was great getting to.
You can't see me dusting off my shoulders. I may have talked to Colson Whitehead about egg sandwiches in New York at one point.
Yeah. It's a good use of 13 minutes, that 60-minute segment. Okay, I think like John Irving could do like wrestling singlets.
Question.
Yes.
John Irving's alive? John Irving's alive. Is he?
I think so. I'm pretty sure. I'm pretty sure John Irving's alive.
We're not going to do live Googling. For those of you listening,
I don't want to Google
that. It's one of those things you like call it into being if you Google it. Yeah. That's an interesting one. Well, it reminds me, did we talk on the show about these wire cutter pieces where they're getting authors to talk about stuff? And like Roxane Gade had like her KitchenAid mixer. And I think it was R.O. Kwan wrote about. I can't even remember what it was, but those are the two names I remember seeing. Yeah, that's interesting. Murakami, I can't remember. It might be, I don't remember who it was. Maybe it's Victor Hugo or Roland Barthes said like something to the effect of like, be normal in your demeanor and dress and habits so that you can be unconventional in thought. Mm-hmm. And that's always struck me as being particularly interesting with people like Murakami who are mild-mannered, but if you read his book and you're like, he wears a t-shirt and jeans every day, you'd be like, why isn't he dressing like Prince or something like that? That's what you would expect.
Kind of the Steve Jobs thing, too, of like having that uniform. It's like all the glitter's on the inside.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I like this game. We did get, I was going to save this for a future thing, but it's relevant here. We asked for politician-writer pairings, right? A lot of let's pair up Barack Obama with people, and I get it. Everyone, we do it here too. Let the man rest. He's got Bruce to handle. You know, he saved democracy twice. Whatever, let him go do the thing. A lot of people were trying to find. I think I said the Elizabeth Warren thing about like we need someone to spice up Elizabeth Warren because I think it's really interesting. But I'm like, read a book for fun by Elizabeth Warren. I'll read a policy tract by her, but for fun, I don't know. A lot of people were trying to do fun matchmaking for Elizabeth Warren. I'm not sure there's any water in that well. Mm. Let's put it from what I've seen there so far. Anyway, I think that's pretty good. I don't know enough about, I don't care, generally speaking, enough about authors' personal lives to know enough about them, Colson Whitehead's egg sandwich connoisseurship aside, to like match make content like this. I don't. Mm-hmm. Do you? I don't feel like I don't care. I generally do not care. I don't care.
Yeah. No, I don't either in that way. Like I am not in a fandom that I could ascribe to where I would know a lot of stuff about the author. Like I was thinking, I've read a lot of memoirs and there are some, you know, memorable personalities. Like, I feel like a Glennon Doyle line of something would be interesting.
Okay.
But she could do journals or pajamas or sunglasses or, like, whatever. I don't know. Like, she's...
Right.
But it exceeds the books, you know? Like, she's just a figure at this point. Or, like...
Yeah.
One of my, like, Brené Brown's line of... I don't know.
Jesus. I mean, that's what you would go, and I'm like, I can't roll my eyes hard.
But I don't know anything really like personal about her, but she could sell me something.
I am not a consumer of influencer culture. And I know it's a thing, and I get why. You need people, you know, it's a curation kind of a thing. You like the person. The Reese Book Club thing is no better example. There's a lot of choices out in there in the world. You're trying to find a way to make a decision about what will make you happy, will be useful, or someone that you can trust. That's another thing we got feedback about, the what I like it, is it good segment, is like, in general, I like the idea, but I really need to know that the people, I can trust the people doing it, which, makes sense.
Right. We're the people doing it. So.
We're the people doing it. Yeah, we're not going to get, like, randos off the street to come tell you about whether or not to read Wind Up Bird Chronicle or something like that. That's a different show that I would very much be interested in. So I get it, but, like, what answers about consumer goods does Marilyn Robinson have that I'm interested in? I don't know. I don't know.
She could do scrunchies. She has all that hair.
You know, I've got to say, on the list of things I'm in need of, a scrunchie is way down there.
The novelty of someone as serious as I perceive Marilyn Robinson to be promoting a line of like neon scrunchies would be incredibly enjoyable.
Okay, let's do one last sponsor spot. We got a hard pivot into like real actual labor news for a minute. I think this is worth talking about.
Today's episode is brought to you by Scribner. Weird Black Girls by Elwyn Cotman is a collection of 7 stories in which characters pursue their obsessions on paths to glory and destruction, while all around them their worlds twist and warp, oscillating between reality and impossibility. On display throughout is Cotman's ability to reveal truth about the human experience, about things like friendship, love, betrayal, bitterness, all through whimsy, horror, and fantasy. Elegiac in tone, imaginative, and humorous in their execution, the character-driven stories in Weird Black Girls challenge, incite, and entertain. The author's last book was named one of NPR's best books of the year and was a finalist for the Philip K. Dick Award, with reviews appearing in the New York Times, Wired, BuzzFeed, and Locus, among other publications. Definitely make sure to check out Weird Black Girls by Elwyn Cotman. And thanks again to Scribner for sponsoring this episode. Today's episode is brought to you by Song of the Silk's Realms by Judy I. Lin. Xu Wei is a talented young musician who was orphaned at a young age. Her sole family is a kindly uncle, but then her uncle is killed, and she is, of course, devastated. With no family and no patron, Xu Wei is facing the possibility of a lifetime of servitude playing the qin. Then one night, she is unexpectedly called to perform for the enigmatic Duke Meng. He surprises Xu Wei further with an irresistible offer. Serve as a musician in residence at his manor for 1 year, and he'll set her free of her indenture. But the Duke's motives become increasingly more sus when he and Xu Wei barely survive an attack by a nightmarish monster. It's like, what? What's going on here? So this book is a sweeping epic romantasy that follows a talented young musician who is swept away to the celestial realm by an enigmatic young duke. And who doesn't want to be swept away to the celestial realm by an enigmatic young duke? She's living all our dreams, honestly. Make sure to check out the new book. And thanks again to Song of the Six Realms by Judy I. Lin for sponsoring this episode.
Unions in books. Thing we've talked about before. The contentious relationship between the bookseller union at the Strand and management at the Strand continues apace. Is there anything new here? I mean, we've talked about this before. Did you want to pick out anything that was an added wrinkle that you thought was particularly interesting?
Mostly continues apace. Yeah. Worsening relations between the union booksellers at the Strand and the owner, Nancy Bass Wyden. They've been tense, it says, for a number of years. Then I remember that this did happen last year, where it came out that she had purchased stock in Amazon at the beginning of the pandemic.
She's married to Senator Ron Wyden of Oregon, right. And she has to do a financial disclosure.
Right, in a super
cell
bad
phone. Wonderful cell phone.
Yeah, truly, really bad look. So looks like that's just continuing. I don't know that they're making any new demands, but those are continuing. Presumably this will become more contentious or more of a thing as COVID gradually eases and the prospect of reopening the store in some sort of normal, quote unquote, normal capacity returns. Like, what kinds of protections are going to be put in place for these folks? Are they getting health benefits? All those kinds of questions. So that is happening. And in the world of Amazon, warehouse workers in Alabama are attempting to unionize. About 6,000 workers at an Amazon warehouse in Bessemer, which is a former steel town, apparently located outside of Birmingham. And they'll be voting soon on whether they want to do that. If they are successful, they would be the first of Amazon's 400,000 American workers to join a union, which would be a landmark and which President Biden has expressed support for.
This is something that Amazon watchers have wondered about for a long time. And I've included myself within this of they're so big and they have so many workers that eventually this was going to happen. You know, it was going to get close for sure. And it sounds like there, I read a little bit about this. I didn't read this particular piece in the New York Times podcast.com or bookriot.com/listen. And you can find show notes of this in all the Book Riot podcasts. But apparently the steel town roots of this town in Alabama are important for this because there's there's history, generational history of union friendliness, because a lot of people in the town had ancestors or, you know, immediate family that worked for unions. So I was surprised when I first saw this. I was like, Alabama, it's not the first. I was like, it's not Detroit or something like that. So, but as we know, this kind of politics can be hyper-local. And I wonder if there is a snowball effect. Does this, if this one goes through, do a bunch more follow hard upon, or is it really a outlier situation? If you have this many warehouses, just because of numbers, a couple of them will unionize. I don't know. Will there be attempts to form a national Amazon union, AFL-CIO? Like, those are national unions. They have local chapters. It would make sense to me that the whole thing is a union.
It would make sense to me too. And this one has, I'm scrolling down in the piece now, particular roots tied to issues of race that this city in Alabama was a key battleground for civil rights struggles in the 60s. And many of the workers at the facility, at the Amazon facility today, are Black. Additionally, Alabama is now a right-to-work state, which makes it harder for unions to organize or to negotiate with employers, and it's made it a draw for big companies to be there. So there's real tension happening there between the power of the company and also corporations and folks who work for these giant corporations wanting to have a reckoning about workers' rights and also about racial disparities. So I would like to see this happen. I think that, you know, the list of concerns that people have or complaints that people have about Amazon's practices with respect to its workers is long, and many of them are well documented. So we don't need
No one should be surprised that someone might want to unionize.
Yeah.
And I think
instance of success, there's a lot of, I think, attempt inside Amazon to discourage this from happening. Of course, corporations are worried when their workers are talking about unionizing. Mm-hmm. I think one group demonstrating that it's doable and doing it successfully opens the door for other ones. And that's progress, whether one more group after them does it, or whether 20 more groups after them do it, or whether they form a national union.
Yeah. A recommended read of the week in Vulture, piece by Lila Shapiro, who was on an episode of Annotated. She does really nice work about books at Vulture. Profiling kind of a group profile of called Publishing's New Power Club of Wave of Hires is set to pick up where the reckoning left off, about people of color, especially Black people, getting big jobs in publishing. We talked about many of them before. Lisa Lucas, Dana Kennedy, there's Phoebe Robinson, a bunch of people here. I think it's a really good read. They each get a little, Lila sets up kind of the format and the framing of it, but then each person gets a couple paragraphs to talk about what they're interested in, what their issues are. I highly recommend reading this. This is a really good idea for a piece. You can find the link in the show notes there. Let's do meta for the last few minutes of this show and talk about podcasting. Got the news this week that Spotify, we're done talking about books and reading. If you don't care about the podcasting landscape, you know, you imagine the outro music in your head. Announced this week that Spotify is on pace to overtake Apple as the largest distributor of podcasts, period. No qualifiers, no anything. We podcast, we like to do this, we're consumers of podcasts, we like the medium, very interested in it. There was a time where if you told me someone was going to take over Apple's spot at the top of the pyramid, I would have been blown away. If I got this news 5 years ago, I was like, this is a radical sea change in this nascent medium. Today, I'm not feeling this way. How are you feeling about this? Were you surprised to see this? I can extemporaneously explain why I don't feel this way, but I thought I would pass it to you first to tell you, are you surprised? Are you interested? Are you scared of our beloved podcasting ecosystem, of which we've made so much enjoyable content in?
I'm not scared. I think it's reflective of maybe a failure of imagination on Apple's part about what its competitors were going to do in that. And I'm seeing it in my personal use case. So like personal anecdata, here it comes. But
isn't that what all anecdata is? Is that what, have we defined anecdata? Do we get a judge's ruling? Sorry, go ahead.
I listen to a lot of podcasts, yes. And over the last year or so, some of them have converted to being Spotify exclusives. Mm. Some of them, like the shows that are produced by The Ringer, become available on Spotify first and stay perpetually available on Spotify, and only the most recent episodes are available on other platforms. And Spotify's got a lot of great exclusive shows. So the thing that's been happening to me with podcasts is increasingly there are things that I want to listen to that are only available on Spotify.
Yeah.
And Spotify has all the other shows that I listen to on Apple as well.
Right.
So I find myself migrating more in that direction because it's easier to do everything in one app than to have to remember which shows are in which apps and what days they come out and all of that business. And I think that if Apple had recognized the power of exclusive shows much earlier and gone in for itself and produced some, that either this wouldn't have happened with Spotify or it would have been a more competitive landscape. But Spotify is just blowing them out of the water with the exclusive content, and it's good exclusive content. Like, this is the thing we've been waiting for, is not a podcast platform where you have to pay extra to get that podcast platform's exclusive content, but just, we have this platform, you do things on it, you listen to music, you listen to shows, and we have exclusive stuff that makes it more appealing for you as a listener to stay in this environment than to go somewhere else. And Spotify has, I think, nailed that.
Do you know off the top of your head if that new podcast featuring The Boss and Bruce Springsteen is free, even if you don't have to have a premium account? Is that if you just have an ad-supported account?
I think it's just free.
Yeah, I think it is too. I don't know for sure. We can check on that, or, you know, you're out there on the internet, you can Google it for yourself. But one of the remarkable things about the play Spotify has made, as opposed to, say, the Luminaries and the Audibles of the world, we have to pay something to get into it, is since podcasts are RSS and you pull the file in, and it's one of the great things that's let podcasts flourish, is it's not centralized. Apple became, many of you probably know this, Apple became the de facto ruler, or, I don't know, benevolent dictator, or sort of almost like negligent dictator, just saying, yeah, we'll host it. You need to get on your phone. You can find, they're basically a directory that everyone can search for. So the Apple Podcast app became most people's default podcast player. And they're like, great, you can listen to podcasts on your phone. That's a feature of phone. You want you to buy the hardware. Spotify seemed to realize is RSS means not only can people play all the podcasts they get other places on our platform because there's no barriers, we can then also sweeten the deal by having stuff you can't listen to other places. It's like if HBO said, oh, you know, I can show all Showtime on HBO as well, in addition to have HBO exclusives.
Yep.
And it's like, kind of blows your mind a little bit to think about how Apple had every chance in the world not to dominate. They don't have to be like, I don't know, it doesn't have to be a walled garden like their app store kind of a situation is, but to consolidate the power by throwing, but they could have bought Gimlet. They could have bought The Ringer. Yep. They could have got Joe Rogan. They could have got The Boss and Springsteen. I'm now referring to Barack Obama as The Boss for those of you paying attention. But they didn't care enough to do it. And they seem to be caring way more. I'd love to know the ratio of dollars they spent to prop up Apple TV Plus versus the dollars they spent to maintain the centrality of Apple in the podcast ecosystem. It's got to be 100-1, at least 100-1. For All Mankind, that show's like $15 million an episode. It's wild stuff. Anyway, continue to be surprised.
I think it's just super interesting. And I've seen Spotify go acquire shows that got popular on all the other platforms and then turn them into Spotify exclusives. So
it's kind of like self-publishing, getting big five publishing deals. Like, you can go make your podcast. Kind of, it's very low effort. You don't need, there's no gatekeepers, right? It's hard to make a good show and to do it a long time and get noticing. Maybe even harder to make a show that gets a following big enough for the Spotify or someone else to pick it up. But they've got all these people making content out there, all these people publishing unsolicited manuscripts of podcasts into the ether, and they can go pick the ones that win.
And Spotify is being smart about how they publicize these things. Yeah. Like, they acquired Brené Brown's podcast, Unlocking Us. And so at the end of the previous season, she says, like, and we've been acquired by Spotify. So to listen to these this show in the future to find new episodes, you have to go to Spotify. So like that's just sitting on the feed in Apple for people who are searching for a Brené Brown podcast to get bounced in that direction. There's a couple shows that I listen to that are Spotify exclusives that I learned about in discovery on the Apple Podcasts app through trailers that are posted there. And it's like, did you like this? Okay, now go over to Spotify and subscribe.
Well, and the way they package them, I think, I don't know if you can you find the Brené Brown podcast on Apple now?
You can. It's just the old episodes.
Oh, it's just the old episodes. Mm-hmm. Okay. Some and I know the, are only the, doing the new episodes in the back
and all
content.
And all the new ones are Spotify exclusives. Yeah. And then the Ringer shows, at least like the rewatchables, you can listen to new ones on Apple, but only shows from the last 6 weeks are on Apple. So if you want to go into the backlist, you've got to go to Spotify.
I guess it makes sense. It depends on the evergreenness of the content. Like for our show, the most recent shows are the most interesting because it's a news, you know, what's happening show. Whereas like the rewatchables, you get hooked on the first three. You want to listen to the rest of them if you like it. So then you'll bounce over to Spotify or something else like that. I got to shout out my favorite podcast app. We had a nice healthy discussion internally about podcast listening habits and what people are doing. Part of the reason I'm not worried about this is as podcasts have grown, of course, Apple, which is a proprietary platform, can't be the central thing it was because a lot of people have Android phones, right? And Spotify is a wonderful podcast solution. It's a wonderful audio solution if you like. Some people like it all in their one place. So Apple can only really be determinative at all. Its market share is limited to people who have Apple devices, right? Whereas the world of smartphones and digital technology, of course, much larger than that. But I got to say, if you have an iPhone, Overcast, which is my preferred podcast app, is wonderful as a single-use podcast player. I love Spotify. And I think, I don't know if I talked to you about this, Rebecca, but I did realize in thinking about this again, that Spotify now has the belt in my household for if we could only keep one streaming thing, it would be Spotify. It's not Netflix. Mm-hmm. It's not HBO. No video junk. Spotify would be the last remaining digital cockroach.
It would. I just had this conversation with my parents a couple weeks ago because my dad was playing around with Spotify during, you know, COVID quarantine, and he was asking me if I had a premium account, and I went, I do, you know, and I have had it for a million years, and I was like, I cannot imagine giving up my Spotify account. It's like the best $10 I spend on media in a month, and it has now 10 years worth of playlists and albums and, you know, trips I've been on and like all that stuff. And I absolutely, it's the one I would give up. It's one I would give up last.
I don't know I could probably switch to Pandora or something if that was it, but like music is more important to me, you know, having a comprehensive, because you could do everything. Every other streaming service, I got to pick a subset of what's out.
It's comprehensive.
There.
You can listen to what you want to listen to with the premium. There's no ads. Like it is the experience that I want to have. I have a selfish request for our listeners.
Yes. Let's get out on
my,
that
screen. My mom wants to experience podcasts now that she has a Spotify situation happening. She gets on the treadmill at home every day and like walks for an hour, and they put together a lot of puzzles, my parents do, while they're home. And I do not think that my preferred content is going to be good for my mom. She is in her mid-60s. She's a nice Midwestern lady. You listen to this show, you have some sense of me. Do your parents listen to podcasts? Do you listen to things that you think my mom might like? Please help me.
Can I give you the RSTNLE version?
Yes. Yes.
This American
please.
Life. This American Life.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'd be curious. Podcast at bookriot.com. I'm off mic, sort of thinking into the ether, trying to think of good answers. thank you, everyone, for listening. Reminder, Claire in the Sun, my copy arrived yesterday. Very beautiful. Reviews have been, I've just watched headlines, read headline reviews. Seems positive? Question mark? I don't know.
Yeah. We are recording the episode about Clara and the Sun on March 25th, so it'll air on March 29th.
Yep.
So you have several weeks to get caught up if you want to read along with us.
Yeah, looking forward to that. Rebecca, we'll talk to you next time.
Yeah, have a good one.